It's Friday, July 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, more than a year after it disappeared, have we seen the first glimpse of Malaysian flight MH370?
Instead of conveying a message in support of justice and accountability, we are sending a dangerous message of impunity to the perpetrator of this heinous crime.
Russia blocks the creation of a criminal court to look at another fateful Malaysian flight. Ahead, nearly 7,000 prisoners are granted amnesty in Myanmar, and Tori Kelly on her way up the music charts. All coming up on today's program. Investigators are trying to determine whether a piece of airplane debris found on a French Indian Ocean island is part of the Malaysia Airlines jet that mysteriously vanished in March 2014. The approximately 2-meter-long fragment was discovered Wednesday on a beach on Reunion Island near Madagascar. That's more than 3,500 kilometers from where the Boeing 777 was last heard from. French aviation officials are examining the material but say it is too early to determine whether the fragment belongs to the missing flight MH370. International Logistics' Jeffrey Young speaks with Jens Flotto. He's the managing editor and commercial aviation of Aviation Week.
They found a piece of a plane on Reunion Island in the southwest Indian Ocean. Mr. Flotow, now people are saying, could this be a piece of Malaysia Air MH370? How do they find out what this is and where it came from? What's the process?
Well, it's pretty easy to tell that it's a part of an aircraft wing. The big question to answer, obviously, is which aircraft type. And once you've found that out, which particular aircraft, there is a part number that you can see on photos taken off the part, and that happens to be identical with the part number that Boeing gives to a piece called Flaperon, which is a part of the aircraft wing on a Boeing 777. So while we don't have positive proof of this piece actually being a part of MH370, it now looks very likely that it is.
Just because a piece of an aircraft washes up on Reunion Island doesn't mean that the impact was anywhere near the island, correct? I mean, it's a huge ocean, the Indian Ocean. It has currents. The plane could have impacted in a number of places, and the part could have just washed up on Reunion Island. Is that plausible?
Yes, that is plausible. In fact, the impact on water has likely taken place thousands of miles east of La Réunion Island, but the currents in this part of the world, in this ocean, are generally westbound. And don't forget, the plane crashed more than 16 months ago, so there was plenty of time for strong currents to carry a piece like this as far west as La Réunion, as far west as Madagascar or Africa. So it is possible. And in fact, shortly after the aircraft had crashed, there have been calculations made about where debris could be found after several months or a year or 2 years. And those maps show, amongst others, La Réunion as one possible point where the debris would end up.
If you find a piece of debris, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have a clue to what happened, the cause of the accident, correct?
That is correct. We don't know much more about the accident today than we did yesterday. I would say that piece looks relatively intact, which may have to do with a relatively slow speed upon impact and not a very steep angle when the aircraft impacted the water. But it is really, really hard to say. The location where it was found now may also not help much by narrowing down the search area, because the distances are so vast and there's so many variables in the calculation.
Jen Flotow is the managing editor for commercial aviation at Aviation Week.
International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Well, the fate of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 has been, as you might expect, a hot topic on Twitter. Michael Lippin is here in our studio with more on that. Michael, what's the latest on the Twitter stats?
Hi, Jim. Well, yesterday's discovery of that aircraft wing flap that could be from the missing plane has led to a big jump in usage of the hashtag MH370. The Topsy Analytics website shows that hashtag has been used at least 53,000 times in the last 24 hours. Many of those tweets link to news articles with the latest developments in that discovery that was made on Reunion Island. And in the last few hours, I've seen lots of tweets about another discovery of debris near where the aircraft part washed ashore. Various news outlets have been reporting that the latest debris is a suitcase, apparently from an airline passenger, and you can see photos of it as well. The photos show this shell of a suitcase that looks pretty mangled and torn up, but otherwise relatively intact. And the reports say authorities have now added that suitcase to their investigation to see if there is a connection with MH370.
Well, many people are focusing on the debris right now, but there's another new angle to the MH370 story that also surfaced. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, this is an angle that comes from the Australian newspaper, whose handle is @Australian. It's got 371,000 followers, and it sent out this tweet a few hours ago. Exclusive. Whoever was flying MH370 made a gentle turn away from its planned course. So in that story, the Australian quotes aviation sources as saying that investigators believe the plane could not have behaved as it did or followed the course that it traveled without human hands on the controls. It says investigators reached that conclusion after more than a year of exhausting all other possibilities. Of course, Malaysian authorities have declared the loss of the plane to be an accident. So if it's ever confirmed that the plane was lost due to a deliberate action by someone or some people on board, it could lead to greater scrutiny of the incident being called or classified as an accident. Jim?
Well, one thing for certain, it's very easy to find Michael Lippin on Twitter.
I'm right here.
You can find him @Michael_Lippin. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. Russia has vetoed a United Nations resolution seeking creation of an international criminal court to prosecute those responsible for shooting down the Malaysia Airlines plane over eastern Ukraine. That incident took place July 17th last year in the territory controlled by pro-Russian insurgents. All 298 people on board were killed. Slotika Hoke reports.
The draft resolution was supported by 11 of the 15 members of the UN Security Council. Three members abstained from the vote. Russia's UN envoy Vitaly Churkin was the only one to raise a hand against the resolution.
Can this investigation resist the aggressive propaganda backdrop in the media? Can it resist pressure of clear political origin when the causes for the disaster and those who are guilty of the disaster are named in advance?
Moscow has rejected claims that pro-Russian rebels downed the plane and blames the Ukrainian government for the crash. Two-thirds of the passengers were Dutch nationals.
If somebody here around the table talks about a political game, this is the political game that has been played with human remains, and it is despicable.
Malaysia, backed by the Netherlands, Australia, Belgium, and Ukraine, pushed for a tribunal so those responsible for the crash could be prosecuted.
Instead of conveying the message in support of justice and accountability, we are sending a dangerous message of impunity to the perpetrator of this heinous crime. as well as jeopardizing the safety of civil aviation over conflict zone in the future.
But both Malaysia and the United States vowed that Russia's veto will not stop them from seeking justice for the victims and their families.
This is not the only means by which justice can be served, and I think from my conversations with the Malaysian, the Dutch, and the Australian and other delegations, they're already thinking through how to create an independent body that happens just not to be one that gets created out of the Security Council.
The Dutch Safety Board is expected to release a final report on the cause of the crash in October. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
The government of Myanmar, also known as Burma, Thursday announced a general amnesty involving nearly 7,000 prisoners. That included more than 200 foreigners, mostly newly sentenced Chinese loggers. The sentences handed down July 22nd triggered a diplomatic protest from Beijing, the latest evidence of recent troubled ties between the traditionally close neighbors. Most of the 155 Chinese were given life terms, although media reports indicate that may actually translate to 20 years in jail. One was given an additional 15-year sentence on a drug charge, while two minors received 10-year sentences each. Once Myanmar's closest political and economic partner, relations have been strained with some of Beijing's infrastructure and mining projects deemed environmentally insensitive. China is also seen as providing safe haven for members of the Kokang rebels of Chinese descent, and China protested a bombing attack by Myanmar in southern Yunnan province in March that killed 4 and wounded 9. Trevor Wilson is a retired Australian diplomat who served in Myanmar, and he told VOA's Victor Beatty such mass amnesties are nothing unusual in Myanmar.
Governments there have tended to give prison amnesties from time to time as a political gesture, and they have often included political prisoners, and they've often included high-profile, what we would regard as sensitive individuals. So in that sense, this is not unusual. Of course, the fact that the Chinese so-called loggers had been only just sentenced and not confirmed, but this would let the Myanmar government get out of that awkward position where it was doing something against its supposed best friend, China.
Well, it did cause quite consternation. Obviously, this was damaging to China-Myanmar relations.
Well, it was yet another shock to that relationship. I think the Chinese language was a bit over the top in the sense that they were trying to get the attention of the Myanmar government, but it's noticeable that they did not claim that the Chinese loggers were innocent. They didn't deny the charges. They simply complained about the severity of the sentences, which you could say was reasonable enough, actually. And the Myanmar government may not have had complete control over the judge who pronounced the sentences. I mean, that would be a bit strange, but maybe it wasn't quite as well organized as it was meant to be anyway.
Of course, Myanmar faces a general election in November.
Yes. So it's 3 months ahead of the election. It's not too close to be awkward politically. It's probably something the government thought they could get away with. And let's wait and see. Maybe they will.
Well, democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi just Wednesday registered to run for re-election to represent her parliamentary seat. Obviously, the political season is underway.
Yes, there's another 10 days to go before the candidates have to lodge their nominations for the election. So she's just doing that at a steady pace and presumably all going according to plan on behalf of the National League for Democracy.
Observers outside of Myanmar would think that the life sentences given to these Chinese loggers was really beyond the pale with regard to the actual crime involved. How serious are these environmental issues in Myanmar?
The environmental issues are fairly serious, and the government had only last year strengthened the penalties against illegal logging. So in that sense, this court decision was consistent with a newly reinforced government policy, but it does seem to be an extraordinary sentence from anybody else's point of view. The problem with the whole project of the catching of these illegal loggers was that there was obviously a lot of complicit behavior on the part of certain Myanmar people, and they haven't been charged or arrested with anything. So that's the other part, side of the problem. And that looked very bad, no matter how you looked at it.
China has confirmed the release of the Chinese loggers arrested in January and expects them to be returned Friday. It is not immediately clear if any of those pardoned by President Thein Sein were political prisoners. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
The British Home Office said Thursday it has granted outspoken Chinese dissident artist Ai Weiwei a full six-month business visa, despite his earlier claim to the contrary. Ai said on his Instagram page that the UK Visas and Immigration Office had only issued him a 20-day entry visa, claiming that he had lied on a visa application form about his, quote, criminal record. The 57-year-old frequent critic of Beijing has never been formally charged or convicted of a crime, despite being repeatedly harassed, arrested, and fined by Chinese authorities. In 2011, Ai was held for nearly 3 months and had his passport taken away. A company he is affiliated with was later fined $2.4 million for tax evasion, a penalty he says was leveled against it because of his activism. Ai, whose passport was returned this month, left Thursday for Germany, where he says he was recently given a four-year multiple-entry visa. The artist rose to international prominence after he designed Beijing's Bird's Nest Stadium for the 2008 Olympic Games. Well, another artist we're watching is singer-songwriter Tori Kelly. She's on the verge of a huge breakthrough. Her recent performances on the Billboard and BET award shows have created a buzz in pop music. International Edition's David Byrd has this look at Kelly's life, music, and her rise to fame.
You couldn't call Tori Kelly an overnight success. Sure, she's only 22, and she is managed by Scooter Braun, the same man who ignited the careers of pop superstars Ariana Grande and Justin Bieber. But Kelly has been working towards pop stardom and honing her songwriting and singing chops for more than a decade now. The Southern California girl first appeared in public on the talent show Star Search when she was only 10. But her real exposure came from posting videos on YouTube. She gained recognition for her cover with another YouTuber, Angie Girl, of Frank Ocean's ballad, Thinking About You. Eventually, Kelly made her way to American Idol and advanced to the Hollywood round, but she did not make the top 24. That loss inspired Tori to write more of her own material, which eventually made it onto her first EP, Handmade Songs by Tori Kelly. On that, she played many of the instruments and also produced all the tracks.
Even just releasing music in general is, I think, an accomplishment, and the fact that I get to put out a whole album of songs that I just put my whole heart into, and people are responding really well to it. It's like, it's the best feeling in the world, because these are songs about my life too, so it's kind of like I'm just throwing myself out there and people are into it. So it's really cool to be able to do what I love.
Handmade Songs sold well enough to reach the top 10 on a number of music charts. She followed that success with live performances at clubs in Los Angeles and by opening for larger acts like Jewel and Ed Sheeran. Recently, Kelly electrified audiences at the Billboard Music Awards with her performance of an acoustic version of her song Nobody Love. Then, at the BET Awards, her version of Smokey Robinson's Who's Lovin' You had R&B crooner John Legend tweeting that Kelly's was the vocal performance of the night. The singer-songwriter says that being within reach of her goal is amazing and something she dreamed of her whole life.
I think all the award shows I've done so far have just been so surreal. Like, I always dreamed about being on different award shows, just sitting at home on my couch and watching. And, I mean, I think just as a kid, I just always put myself on that stage. And the fact that it's actually happening, I get to be a part of these shows, is incredible.
Tori Kelly released her first full-length album, Unbreakable Smile, in June. Max Martin, who produces Kelly Clarkson, Pink, and Ellie Goulding, helped produce the CD, which debuted on the Billboard 200 at number 2. Her single, Should Have Been Us, is also rising on the Billboard Hot 100 charts. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Walking around with my head down, but I can't hide with these high heels on. Downtown in a thick crowd, but it's just you that my mind is on. Dressed up, got my heart messed up, you got yours and I got mine.
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can always find us at our website, voanews.com. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zeynep Abdel-Rahman, and you for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Human trafficking or modern slavery happens everywhere. No country is immune to it. And today, more than 20 million men, women, and children are enslaved worldwide. Every year, the United States Department of State issues its annual Trafficking in Persons Report, which evaluates the efforts of 188 countries and territories, including the United States, to fight modern slavery. They are not compared to other countries. Instead, they are evaluated based on their own efforts to comply with minimum standards for the elimination of human trafficking set forth in U.S. law. These standards are closely linked to the international agreement called the UN Palermo Protocol, which establishes an international framework to address human trafficking. Those countries with governments that fully comply with the standards fall into Tier 1. Countries that do not comply, but are making significant efforts to do so, are on Tier 2. The Tier 2 watch list includes countries that do not comply with the minimum standards and are making significant efforts, but fail to increase such efforts compared to the previous year, have a number of trafficking victims that is significant or significantly increasing, or who make commitments to take additional steps over the ensuing year to better address human trafficking. Finally, countries on Tier 3 do not comply with the minimum standards and are not making significant efforts to do so. According to the report, in 2014, 18 countries moved up in the tier rankings, while the same number dropped in the tier rankings. 31 countries are in Tier 1, 89 countries in Tier 2. The Tier 2 watch list contained 44 countries, and 23 countries comprise Tier 3. The TIP report is a valuable diplomatic tool because it helps hold governments accountable for taking real steps to end the scourge of modern slavery, said Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. Not only do foreign governments look to its recommendations on how to improve, civil society relies on these pages to guide their efforts as well. The U.S. government anti-trafficking policy and strategy similarly stem from this report, as do the efforts of many international organizations, said Undersecretary Sewell. The purpose of this document is not to scold and it's not to name and shame. It is to enlighten and to energize, and most importantly, to empower people, said Secretary of State John Kerry at the report's July 27th launch ceremony. Indeed, it is a call to action.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.